TV Dudes Podcast special episode recorded June 11th, 2017, ATX Television Fest 2017. Did it.
Yes.
We just got through season six of the ATX Television Festival here in Austin, Texas.
The ATX Festival ran longer than most shows. I mean, season six, six seasons?
I don't know about you guys, but I binge watched the whole thing over the weekend.
Hey, you really did, yeah.
Is next season the movie? Six seasons of a movie?
Six seasons of a movie.
Yeah, so here in Austin, Texas, every year for the past 6 years, we TV dudes have been fortunate enough to attend the ATX Television Festival. And if you've listened to our podcast enough, you've heard us rave about how great this is. Not only because it's local to us and there's certainly a convenience there, but it is such a great television festival in that, like, it really hits all of the different elements of production, of the music, of the actors, of the writers. Just it's such a love fest for all of that. And then it does features for all these great shows, either big or small, mm-hmm. and makes them all such an intimate experience. It's amazing.
I would travel for this festival. I mean, we're here and that's great. I would travel the same way I did for, like, San Diego Comic-Con for years. I would come from out of town for this show because it is that good a show.
And, you know, once again, we want to emphasize, hey, if you listeners are thinking about it, just do it next year. Get over here.
Yeah, we'd love to hang out with you. Y'all have been lucky enough to do this every year for all six. This is my first season to get to go to this thing. I've gone to comic conventions before, and I've gone to sci-fi conventions before, but this convention was absolutely amazing. I mean, both for the depth of panels, the amount of people there who are legitimately industry, the amount of people there who want to become industry, and just the shared nerd out love of TV. Everybody there, nobody wanted to be weird, nobody wanted to mob celebrities particularly. Everybody just wanted to really passionately discuss their stuff.
Yeah.
We're going to go into this whole experience that we did, but real quick, I wanted to step back and a couple things. First off, we are the TV Dudes. I'm Grant.
I'm Randy.
I'm Les.
I'm Mike.
And Mike and I are also excited to announce, hey, Do you hear that echo right now? that change of sound a
we're
little
in
bit?
Our studio.
Yeah, we're going to see how we clean this up.
Yeah.
But there's a permanent record studio.
There's a permanent record studio. We have two studios in one building.
One of them's a little bit further along enough that we can sit inside of it.
Yeah.
But we're still undergoing
we're
the
still
proper soundproofing.
Killing silverfish, or was that an earworm that
whatever
we just
that
saw?
Was.
No, the podcast is an earworm.
Okay,
yes, if we do it right.
Right.
So we're
still killing silverfish, trying to get better air conditioning
this
here.
This does not sell it when you say this.
Trying
silverfish.
To get some sound paneling. But
internet
overall,
could be nice.
Internet would be good. We just got electricity. That's mm-hmm. nice. Mm-hmm. But overall,
by breaking open a circuit right. panel.
Yeah. And we are sharing the space with about 50 Burmese children. But other than that, it's all good.
That's straight up true.
They're actually going to be on the podcast one by one.
Yeah.
No.
That's not true. That's not true.
It's a lot of pressure. But we are excited to be working on this space to kind of see how this new project works out for us. And, you know, Randy, you don't have to have the burden of having all of our crap all up in your nerdatorium anymore.
It was a burden. You guys would come in, you'd stink, you'd throw, like, cigars and trash all over the place.
Yeah, I know. I know how
I tried
are.
To consistently pee in the same corner.
Yeah, and I did appreciate that.
We can't all be nice, tidy Burmese children, Randy. Some of us are messy.
As the saying goes.
That's a common saying.
Yes, it's a common saying.
People know that.
Yeah.
Hey, if you guys are listening to this for the first time, or if you're a longtime listener who wants to support the site, quick, easy way to do that, go to patreon.com/TVDudes, and you can throw us a buck per episode, and in exchange, we do a little bonus exclusive content. That's our only plug. Right, Randy?
I'm going to help you out because we're on a time clock. So, yes,
that is
our only way to support us. Next week, there'll be two bonus ones.
Jeez. But we also wanted to say, you know, since we're in our permanent record space, if you guys want to check out all the other shows in our TV podcast network, Permanent Record.
Permanent Record.
There we go. You can go to permanentrcrd.com. And there's
permanent
a bunch of
rcrd.com. Sorry, I have to.
There's a bunch of great shows that cater to a bunch of what fans might like in different TV things. I mean, we don't hit everything that everyone should love.
But we will.
But we will give us enough
time. We're
going
to dominate the world. Right, Mike?
I have aspirations. See?
There you go. It's an ongoing thing.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's get back into the festival itself. Randy and Mike, we've gone a few years, and we've kind of seen a bit of an evolution of this festival and how they kind of focus on different things each year. This year, it seemed like some of the biggest highlight premiere events, Battlestar Galactica Reunion, mm-hmm. was a huge one. This Is Us, given how big that show is. They had a get-together panel and discussion that, you know, people were freaking out about that.
Yep. Yeah.
We didn't go.
No.
But
no,
why did we not go to This Is Us, Grant?
We couldn't actually get in.
Oh, okay.
That's absolutely not why I wasn't there.
Yeah, I was going to say, me too.
That's a TV show?
Yeah. What, we couldn't get into the show. It wasn't gelling with us.
That's on the air, though. That's an ongoing TV show?
Oh, yeah. It's not that you couldn't get into the panel. You couldn't get into the show.
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, okay.
We had a Parks and Rec outdoor event, so it wasn't like a feature of like the cast and crew or anything.
Yep.
But they did like a showing and a little mock harvest festival.
Did you guys see the horsey?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Grant got to scratch the horsey's ears.
Then, you know, a little bit smaller panels, Leftovers, Alias, Mike Donnelly's The Comeback.
Yep.
So it was neat to kind of see all those. I know that Terriers wasn't here this year.
Oh, are we not doing Terriers every year? I thought that was an every year kind of thing.
Did you go to a Terriers panel?
I thought I did. Was that just me in a corner yelling about Terriers?
Yeah, at all the Burmese children.
Oh, that's
they did
weird.
Not like it.
That's why the questions were so confusing.
Dear sir, can we leave?
Yeah, all the questions. I was expecting like how was Donald Logue, or, you know, how was the chemistry between leads? All the questions were like, when can we leave, and what is Terriers, and is this about dogs? Like, those were all the fan questions. That was weird.
You might have committed some mild kidnapping.
Mild kidnapping.
It's a light kidnapping.
Yeah. So, Les, you were kind of touching on it, but what was your experience with this?
I loved it. Like I said, I've done comic conventions before. Conventions are fun. I mean, you're always going to see a lot of fan service stuff. This, though, as far as deep dive panels into subjects about the inner workings of television, those were fascinating. All the panels that I saw where we got to watch an episode, I mean, if it's obviously, don't go to shows you hate and watch an episode. But we got to watch an episode and then listen to at least the director and one or two cast members, or the person who wrote all the music for it, or the editor, really discuss the mechanics. So it seemed like panel after panel, there were some tales out of school told just time and time again of stuff of like, oh, there's no way I'd have heard that anecdote anywhere else.
Yeah. Mike and Randy and I just got out of the Glow panel, the Gorgeous Ladies of Wrestling, the new show that's going to be on Netflix.
In just a couple weeks.
And I was really taken aback by particular conversations that just seemed a lot more raw than kind of what you typically get, like in a guarded, you know, promotional aspect.
Mm-hmm.
There's just like some behind the scenes, like real shit going on. I was like, oh wow.
Every panel I go to, and the questions, I mean, there's obviously people get questions they've had before, and you get those answers. But in general, there's always at least a few questions or a few answers where it's like, oh, that wasn't scripted. That's not something they've said 100 times before. That was them honestly engaging with this. And I feel like that's pretty much every panel I go to here.
Yeah. And it's funny because when they get all the questions that they get all the time, they will say that.
Yeah.
Ugh, I get this question all the time.
Yeah, yeah.
Not to make you feel bad, but just like, you know, they're almost asking you, give me a challenge here. Give me something a little bit outside the box.
Even the big panels don't feel like marketing. Like, I think we've all kind of been to comic cons, and they just feel like, here's the push. We're going to push out the product to somebody. But here it's a celebration.
Yeah.
Even the cast, the crew, the filmmakers or showrunners are there, and they're talking really deep dive stuff about the creative process, because the people who travel to come to this festival are people who will listen to TV show podcasts, will listen to DVD or Blu-ray commentary for a full season of the show. They want the behind-the-scenes stuff. They want to know about the creative process. And I think that energizes a lot of the talent and panelists that come here, that, oh, they want to know about what I do day-to-day and my struggle. I'm going to tell that story. It's really special.
It makes a celebrity out of the smaller people. Like, it gives them a platform. Like,
yeah, there was a panel on casting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There was a panel on directors. I mean, there was a music supervisor I met and talked to. There's everybody's from all the different levels. It's not just the actors and the showrunners. It's all levels of TV that is being represented here.
Well, and even in the showrunner panel, like, they all made note of, like, how are we rock stars here? Like, we were all mid-level writers who just stayed in writers' rooms long enough to learn to showrun. And
it's funny to hear that, like, because, you know, when you go see someone and they're up on stage, you just have this assumption that this is kind of their life. They do that. But then when they give us a reality check of like, this is crazy to me that you guys think of me in this way and are giving me this kind of opportunity to talk like this. And then yet people are like shy to come up and talk to me. Like Javi.
Yeah, Javier Grillo, Mark's Watch. He said, you spoke in the showrunner thing about, you know, people ask, like, well, what do you do when the show ends? Or what? It's like, same thing you do in all of life. Like, you get them right into the show. Like, you write your way out of everything. Writing your way out of it is always the solution. Like, this show got canceled? Write another script. Go sell another show. Write another show.
That guy was really cool to listen to in any panel, too.
He also, he spoke several times on several different panels about having won an Emmy because of his work on Lost, which he was like, you know, I was part of a group of a great thing. Like, we won an Emmy. I didn't specifically win an Emmy. And so his parents have that Emmy. It's on their mantle. It matters a lot more to them, right? For him, the greatest thing that came out was the Bold Type panel, which he had nothing personally to do with. But the showrunner for that show was a writer's assistant that wrote an episode of Middleman, which was the episode that they screened, and he dragged her up on stage and then let her talk about Bold Type for a little while. He never said a word about whether or not, I don't know if he likes the content of Bold Type or if he likes that story or not, but you could tell that it warmed his heart that she came away from working for him feeling more confident about her abilities and feeling like this was a career she could continue to do, and she is now a showrunner, whereas he came off of, like, he spoke specifically about Star Trek The Next Generation and Michael Piller. And that man is responsible for Ron Moore, for Brian Fuller, for, like, there's six or eight showrunners that are making prestige television that are in existence because of Next Generation. Mm-hmm. In the same way that The Shield, whether you want to watch a cop drama or not, you wouldn't have Sons of Anarchy, you wouldn't have a ton of other shows that you wouldn't have. He said if there's any legacy that he can bequeath, it would be to have this coaching tree of, how do you put it, we're responsible for the management culture of our own industry here.
That's interesting. And something you mentioned, that him mentoring a woman who's now running a show, one of the themes that's not like a front and center, but you definitely notice is diversity.
Let's talk about the running themes that, because each year you kind of get a sense of like what's dominating the conversation, both in front of screen and behind the scenes. Mm-hmm. Like, and yeah. Diversity and women empowerment.
Something I think is interesting is that, and this may just be me, but when I see diversity, I don't notice so much notice when someone is thinking about it, but I notice when someone isn't. Mm-hmm. Like when you suddenly put together that every panel you've seen is a bunch of white dudes, like when someone didn't pay any attention, you start to notice. But I didn't notice until someone mentioned that, like, how many women have been represented on panels, how many people of color have been represented on panels, and that I think having Emily and Caitlin, two women running the festival, I mean, they're not the only ones, obviously. There's five full-time employees plus a ton of volunteers and sponsors, but they're the heart and soul of the show.
Yeah.
I think that's a perspective that doesn't always get there. And I think having them have their perspective is what brings a lot of that thoughtfulness to the makeup of the show. And it definitely shows through.
Well, and without being too heavy handed, a lot of the panels would at least tangentially hit on that. I mean, there was a socially conscious television panel.
Yep.
I went to the Trumped Up television panel.
Complex, Not Complicated.
There was Complex, Not Complicated. There was Understanding the Enemy. There was Powerful Television, which I think, the socially conscious one.
Yeah.
But yeah, there were several panels that at least touched on not just going through a paint swatch thing and making sure that your show has all of the peoples.
Right. It wasn't a math problem to solve.
That it was about, you know, not just putting a black best friend on there so that you don't know what to do with them.
Yeah.
Or just putting a gay best friend on there and then not knowing what to do with them. There were panels not just about diversity, but about understanding
proper
depth of character.
The different voices, because that's what's important.
Yeah.
That's what they're looking for.
Echoing that, it's interesting to see the difference when we come to ATX TV Fest and see the audience that attends this.
Mm-hmm.
And that us, we're in the minority.
Yeah.
And it's in a great way.
Yeah.
Like it's very female dominated in the audience, and I find that the culture of the festival itself is reflected in that. It feels warm and mm-hmm. welcoming, and it's a different side of fandom. You know, not to just like say, you know, men and women are so different, but I think that there is a contrast there that gives this such a great energy, and a lot of the people that come to this festival noticed that too, as far as panelists. Like, yeah. It's such a fun environment, both Austin, Texas, and the people that come here.
Well, it's less demanding of both the attendees and the panelists. It's less demanding of the attention and sort of more of a thanking for attention. Like, you feel like every panelist who's here, you feel like they're thankful for getting people to talk to who understand what they're doing. And you feel like all the people who are attending really appreciate people coming out and taking the time out of their busy lives and telling us about what they do. Like, there's a real mutual love going on in both directions, I think. And that's not always the case in, like, Comic-Cons, where it's sort of a, okay, monkey, dance for me.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And there's some really special stuff that happens every year. Like, this year, the Sweet Vicious panel, I didn't go. Did anybody go to that?
No.
Okay, it's an MTV show, and it's about a couple girls on a college campus who decide to take matters into their own hands when some of their friends on the campus are victims of sex abuse. And it got canceled like maybe a week before this, like a week or two ago. And apparently the whole panel turned into a group therapy for the audience, where people in the audience of the panel were talking about their specific experiences with sexual abuse and how the show helped them. And then the showrunners were talking about their own and relating to the audience directly. Like, that never happened.
No, so that's amazing.
Yeah, Melissa was there, and she loved it.
Like, I saw the creator of the show and one of the lead actresses. They were talking on the Complex Not Complicated panel, and everyone on that was fantastic. And to get a bunch of women up there and like, hey, we want you to actually not worry so much about, like, you know, self-promotion of whatever you're working on, but like, talk about this greater issue of women both behind the scenes and in front of the camera and how that's being represented and what are the active things we're doing to kind of change and improve that, and what are the hang-ups and like, how do you kind of overcome all that? And that's kind of what I noticed as far as like running themes. That was definitely there. And reactions to the election, I think, are the biggest ramification we see. Mm-hmm. Kind of a lot of political commentary.
Came up in almost every panel I was at.
Yeah. Frustrations with the Trump administration, frustrations with the election cycle.
I'm glad you brought that up now, because this is where I got to make my exit. But I'm just going to say, resist always.
Yeah, the other thing, this was an interesting festival for me because I only did one interview. Usually I do a ton. Last year I did a bunch of Leaded Beach Cops. This year I did one, and it was all spinning off from Les's schedule conflict. And I talked to the writers from Alias, which we'll have up soon. It was Josh Applebaum and Andre Nemec, and it was a great little interview. And I had a great time. But Les, this was like a brand new experience for you.
Yeah, I honestly hadn't interviewed anybody since probably something for a college paper in like 97. So this was totally new for me. Grant and Randy can testify to how nervous I was trying to make sure I didn't write yes or no questions and or come in and just spaz out.
I can't. I thought you handled it all pretty smoothly. You're keeping it under the surface.
Yeah, because there were a couple times where I was like looking at a celebrity I wanted to go talk to, and like I don't have time to sit and write the rest of these questions down so you don't look like an idiot later. But all my interviews went great. I still couldn't get my head around when we got the list of publicists that this was real and that I should email these people for some reason. Like it felt like when you got a Scholastic book when you were a kid with like, here's where you can write for autographs. Like it felt like that, like sure this will work. And so I emailed everybody from, you know, Annie Potts and Burt Reynolds down to Nemec and Applebaum and writers room folks. And you know, some folks I got a hard no, some folks I didn't hear anything back from, but I got a few good responses, and enough people share publicists that a couple of my good responses snowballed into more interviews. And that's when I ended up with a schedule conflict of like, ah, crap. I asked for all of these and they're all at 1 PM. And so, yeah, I was lucky enough that the publicist was okay with me pawning off an interview to someone else and not the person she had been in contact with, because I was a little worried that it was going to feel like a bait and switch to them.
Yeah. I love the openness of this. I love this opportunity that the wonderful people at ATX Television Fest have afforded us and kind of welcoming us into the fold and letting us attend this every year and cover it. It's really such a great experience.
Yeah.
Coming up, we're going to break this down because we want to discuss a lot of the new shows that we got to check out, as well as some screenings. And then we're going to discuss some of the panels a little bit more in depth. And then finally, we're going to touch on the feature panels. But for now, we're going to take a quick break. So part of the festival, what they do is take some shows and do screenings of them, like in a theater. There's some smaller theaters, and then there's bigger theaters, just like gigantic, the Paramount Theater. Mm-hmm. And you get to sit there with an audience. And unlike the general intimate experience of watching TV on your home screen, on your phone, I know, Randy, you think that's blasphemy.
That is blasphemy.
Sometimes I'll watch my shows on my phone,
son
laying in bed.
Philistine.
Watching it with a whole audience and kind of getting this idea of the group experience, it's really neat. I remember in particular last year getting to watch Terriers with an audience and everyone laughing at like all the moments together and yep. just like, oh yeah, this is such a gem that was lost. We should make a podcast about that. Yeah, it was such a great experience.
By the way, I do love it's usually it's either the Paramount or the Alamo Drafthouse, both of which are a great place to see yeah. movies in town. So yeah. they've got great partners.
Yeah. So we want to kind of just touch on a few of these shows that we got to see. We're probably going to go and review a lot of these if there are new shows coming up later on and we get to go more in depth, but just kind of get a little feel for what we got to see this year. First up, Ghosted. I believe I'm the only one who got to check this out.
You are. I was running late.
We were talking about this a few weeks back on the Upfronts, and this is a show with Adam Scott and Craig Robinson as these, one's a cop and one's an exiled professor of the paranormal that kind of get recruited into this underground organization for the paranormal.
Yeah. Looks like Ghostbusters meets Men in Black.
Sort of, yeah. And they both get pulled in, and it's just kind of a vehicle for them to do a buddy cop thing, as well as kind of play around with, yeah, like the Fringe, I guess, kind of thing, or yeah. X-Files. So I thought that it really does a great job of just quickly moving past the initial concept and just diving right in. A lot of the comic aspects, I feel like it needs a little bit of work. Like some of it's like a little bit too rapid fire, and then like maybe a little bit slow at other times. So once that kind of evens out, I think this will definitely fit into the Fox family. I'm interested to see more episodes and see how it kind of fits with like Brooklyn Nine-Nine, some shows like that. Mm-hmm. And then it was kind of cool getting to see them talk about it. But one of the things like I noticed is like sometimes like with moderating, like using the mic, maybe this is more like from a podcaster perspective, but I'm like, oh man, I wish they're constantly on the mic. I don't know if they're keeping the recordings later for like posterity, but I'm right. like, I want it all. I want this like permanent record of all these. Like, it's so precious to me.
Permanent record.
Permanent record. The resonance.
No, they were recording most of the panels, and I actually heard a couple of people yell at folks of like, please talk into the mic. And you'd hear the presenter go, but everyone in the room can hear me. And they'd yell back, you know, but YouTube can't. You know, but we're archiving it and it won't be on the tape.
That's yeah. funny.
So we all got to see Snowfall.
Yeah, and I think yeah. none of us were particularly looking forward to it. We were just like, you know, it's the opening screening. It's FX, it's John Singleton, but I think we weren't like sure what to expect, and we all really liked it.
Yeah, yeah. Literally FX's brand logo on there was the whole reason that I went to that. I think I probably would have cold skipped it. I'm not a John Singleton fan. I mean, I like Boys in the Hood, but I've seen movies of his since that were terrible, in my opinion. The ads for this looked kind of cheap and trashy to me. I really had a mind Miami Vice picture in my head of what this show was going to be.
Yeah, it takes place in the 80s in Southern California, mm-hmm. and it's about this guy getting into the coke game, I guess.
Well, it's about sort of the real story of how the government was involved in getting crack cocaine spread amongst the people in South Central yeah. Los Angeles.
Yeah. It sure appears like the CIA brought way too much cocaine over for a thing, and then somebody figured out a new product to make out of it.
Yeah. And it felt to me like a mix of Boys in the Hood and Miami Vice in a
yes.
good way.
Yeah. It felt like I explained it to someone as Boys in the Hood meets Traffic.
Yeah, yeah.
It was really quite a surprise to see that, and we're all so excited to kind of dive into this later.
Yeah, we'll do a deep dive when it comes out.
Yeah, I was very surprised that I'm looking forward to a second episode of that show.
Now, Randy, you got to see Room 104.
I did. Now, I'm a Mark Duplass fan. I love Togetherness, his last thing on HBO. This is a new thing that is more in line with his Animals that I'm not a big fan of. This is it's not animated, but it is sort of more indie. It's an anthology series. It all is going to take place in this hotel room 104, this sort of cheap hotel off the interstate. And it's sort of a series of 12 mini movies. He wrote the first seven. There's other writers.
So they're an hour each?
They're, I think, half hour.
Oh, okay.
It was definitely a shorter show, and they're bringing a lot of amateur directors and newer actors and that kind of thing. It sounds like it's almost a launch pad, like if something goes well, maybe they'll launch a show out of it. But it's essentially 12 mini movies of varying tones and genres. all set in this one hotel room. The opening episode, which I don't know when it's happening, it's not for a little while yet, but it is a sort of suspense thriller about a babysitter and a kid, and it goes in a very interesting direction. I don't want to say too much about it, but it's definitely worth watching, especially, and I'm surprised to say this with Duplass, if you're like a horror fan, I think this is going to be up your alley.
I liked Baghead.
Okay, yeah.
But I like Duplass. I mean, I'm sold. Like, I'll watch whatever Duplass does. I don't know what it'll be tonally, but I'm sure it'll be fun.
Bajillion Dollar Properties, you not only got to interview these people, but you also checked out the panel. What'd you think?
Yeah. Yeah, I had actually not seen. It's on CISO, which I would pitch again. I think we ought to do an episode on CISO at some point. There's a lot of content on there, and a lot of it is really good. So I got to watch a bunch of screeners for Bajillion. So Bajillion Dollar Properties, I lucked into a couple of interviews with them, with Kulat Valesic, the director, and then with three members of the cast. So they sent me screeners because I hadn't seen a whole lot of the show and didn't want to embarrass myself by not having seen any of their work. So I watched a whole ton of this show in one move right before meeting a bunch of the people from it. And then they gave me tickets to the panel that night, which was just an episode and then an hour-long improv show, which was spectacular. They just did an hour-long improv in the State Theater. That show's hysterical. It is a... If you've never seen it, Bajillion Dollar Properties is a direct send-up of Million Dollar Listings, a house flip show. It has... executive producers in Thomas Lennon and Robert Ben Grant. Yeah. So it's very much Reno 911 meets Million Dollar Listings. But it is exceptionally well done. They hit the editing marks and sound foley and clips and pacing for that type of show. Similar to Burning Love, another send-up documentary, but I feel like Bajillion Dollar hits it faster and tighter. It is a really well-made show. They shoot two seasons at a time. I'll get into more of it in the interview, but I enjoy that a lot more than I expected to.
Fargo...
Yeah.
Randy, we got to check this one out.
Yeah, we made a slight mistake, though.
We did.
Which, the funny thing was, you thought I'd made a mistake, but it was you as well.
We both made the mistake that we went in there, and they showed a brand new episode.
Yeah.
The latest episode that's airing this week as we're recording.
Yes, but we did not watch this week's.
Yeah.
No, it was this week's. It was like the Tuesday. Like the Tuesday episode, they showed next week's episode. So there was really only one day that we missed, and I don't keep up with TV. Even TV, I love that. I don't watch anything live anymore.
Yeah.
So we saw the penultimate episode, I think, out of order, which actually worked out fine. I'm now really curious to find out what happened in the episode I missed, but it's an amazing episode.
It was so good, and I got to see the leftovers panel, and Carrie Coon is in this and that, and there's so much. Like that resonates between the two shows. And I was just struck by a lot of the thematic similarities in this particular episode. And the fact that we got to see it in front of the audience and then Noah Hawley was there attending and he got to kind of address some of the similarities between those. I mean, he wasn't like fully familiar with it, but it was just interesting to like hear the question even posed to him and go, oh, it must be something about Carrie Coon.
So Noah Hawley, the director of the third episode, the one that's in LA, the guy who played Albert Rothstein on Boardwalk Empire, who is the guy with the mustache, his name I always forget, in this show, Asai, who had not made the connection until he came out, and I'm like, oh my god, it is him.
Yeah.
And then Mary McDonnell, who is featuring pretty heavily in the second half. All great panelists. I felt like the director didn't get a lot to answer, but Noah Hawley, I really do think, is one of the smartest people in TV.
Oh, brilliant.
And hearing him talk about, you can tell the level of thought, like, this guy's thinking on a level nobody else is thinking on. He's thinking about the symbolism. He's thinking about the feminism aspect of the show. He's thinking about the themes of the Coen brothers. He's making these nods to the Coen brothers' properties. Like, the depth of this show and how rewarding it is to watch comes through in Noah Hawley when he talks about it.
And Mary McDonnell, I got to see her in at least three different panels. Yeah. She is such a delight, and like, she's glowing with enthusiasm to talk about everything that she's discussing, and everything she says is just so insightful and yet accessible. Like, it doesn't feel like she's, like, I guess, preaching. No. It just feels like, you know, like, just nice down-to-earth, like, discussion about it. And I was just so taken with her this whole weekend. It's just amazing.
Same. I've always thought she was an amazing actress, but, yeah, she was a fantastic panelist.
Yeah, I've never, like heard her speak, like, behind the scenes. It was just a delight.
Yeah.
Another one that we just got to check out was Glow over on Netflix.
Gorgeous Ladies of Wrestling.
Yeah.
How was that, guys?
It was so good.
It rocked.
Awesome. I'm looking forward to the show.
Like, I wasn't sure initially, like, starting out, it felt a little slow, or maybe it was one of those shows that I felt a little weird watching it, like, with the larger group, because some parts felt quiet where I feel like if I was listening to it in headphones, I'd crank up the volume maybe a little bit more or something.
Yeah.
But once it kind of like really gets going, I think it has such a great origin story, forming of a team, the struggle of the different actresses, and
the 80s aesthetic of it.
80s aesthetic.
80s is so easy to go too far with, like to make it goofy or candy. And this felt very authentic 80s. Like there's an aerobic scene, the fashion, the look of everything, the music's fantastic. The song they chose for the opening, the song they chose for the ending, and the song they choose for like this big moment, amazing. I don't know the music supervisor who was on the show, but they're a genius. And also, I think Marc Maron kills it here.
What he gets to do, he clearly must be just loving it, right?
Yeah. Well, the casting director talked about this both here and at the casting panel, and she said that with Marc Maron, like, this wasn't written for him. But she's like had a star crush on him since she was in her 20s when he was a comedian in the 90s. And she basically got him to do a tape and she like sent it to them with nothing else. She's like, look, I can't do any better than this.
Yeah, this is the only person I'm submitting for this role. This is who you should pick. And they did.
And they were right because it's he's great.
Yeah, dead on. And another aspect of that panel, like we got to hear him talk, and I kind of alluded to this earlier, but there was this one question that like this really struck me, and I felt like it fits perfectly with ATX and kind of the unexpected ways, the twists and turns that these kind of conversations can go. But one person asks, and this is... is this like spoilery?
No, I don't think so, really.
Well,
because it's the first scene is an audition that is going is kind of rough.
Yeah, there's an audition that Alison Brie's character is going through, and it's difficult for her. And someone asks, like, hey, has it gotten any better for you as an actress than back then? And she just goes, no.
Yeah.
And how that spins off with the casting director being there. And she's like, I think it has, you know, like from her perspective, like we're not terrible like that. And she's like, yes, you're not.
Yeah.
But overall, in general, it is still terrible to do that. And like they start telling some like really personal stories.
Like, you in this industry. That industry still exists.
Yeah.
Well, the casting director kind of took it personally, I think, and wanted to deflect and do the well, no, we're not like that. And then Alison Brie, she did reassure. She's like, no, not you, but this is... She was basically sort of... It was like watching somebody with privilege let in on the fact that they're privileged. Like, the casting director had no idea this kind of thing was still going on, it sounded like.
Yeah, it was just... It was like a raw and real deviation where it was like, here's some of the shit I've had to go through in casting. And it was just like everyone in the audience was like, oh, damn, like that's fucked up.
Yeah.
That's terrible stuff that's still going on. And her and the other lead actress in the show, like both were like, yeah, this happens. It's demeaning. And it really struck me as like, you know, there's these kind of like template answers that, you know, like they're going to say like promoting, they get a lot of the same questions. Mm-hmm. And that was such a great moment that you kind of get behind the scenes and eye-opening about like the struggle that they kind of go through. Anyway, Nashville, you got to check out Nashville.
Yeah, I went to the Nashville panel. I had some time to kill. I've watched quite a bit of that show, though I'm behind. I've not watched any of the CMT episodes, but I was interested in the panel. No matter what episode they showed one I hadn't seen, just because it made a channel jump that is interesting to me.
Mm-hmm.
It jumped over to CMT, I believe from ABC.
This is the Connie Britton curse.
Yes, yeah, and they killed off Connie Britton.
She didn't go with it?
No. Raina died during the transition or right after. So I have not seen what killed her character, but I knew she was gone by this point.
I'm pretty sure Country Music Channel killed her. Killed
werewolves.
Her. Werewolves. Hold'em show now. That stuff spreads. But it's they talked a great deal about how CMT during the channel jump, it's almost like it moved to the channel it should have started on.
Yeah.
CMT probably should have had this show from the beginning. I don't think they could have launched this show. They wouldn't have put the money up initially. But they talked about how like clear they were really afraid jumping channels that they would lose the ability to clear the music, or that they would lose the support for guest musicians to come on, or that the songwriting camps that they do to generate these songs for this thing would be more difficult. And by moving to CMT,
quite the opposite.
They have just as much leeway on this stuff. And the panel also included the music supervisor, who he didn't take over directly from T-Bone Burnett, but he took over from another person who did. All the previous music supervisors had a style. You know what you get when you hire T-Bone Burnett. The new guy is a studio person. He said he came onto the job and they said, well, what's your style? And he's like, what do you want? My style is to produce the sound you need. And And he, it was kind of interesting to hear him talk about coming into a show and not wanting to muddle it and turn it into a bland nothing. But at the same time, that wasn't his forte to come in and style something.
Yeah.
That it was probably good that he came in when they swapped channels because there was already a shakeup and they could change a little bit of how it worked.
That's so cool.
I thought it was interesting. I was there to hear about how they jump channels, which was cool.
All right, and I think the last one that I really wanted to touch on is that, Randy, you got to finally check out the mick that Les and I have been telling you. You got to check this out.
You guys have been telling me about this for a long time. I finally just, because it was here, decided to go ahead and watch an episode, and I loved it, and I watched two more before I got to see this, and then they showed another one, and they showed the one that has her getting breast implants with the teenage daughter and has her boyfriend taking the two boys to a baseball game and
football game,
No, it's football. You're right, it's football. At any rate, it was hilarious, and we'll definitely be covering the mick. That was my bad. I did the scheduling, and I left it off, and we need to go back and recover this, but you should watch the mick. And then the panel came out, and it was the creators, brothers, Dave Chernin and John Chernin, and Caitlin Olson, and the guy who plays her boyfriend, who is also one of the writers, it turns out.
Really? I love that actor.
And I found that out. I'm actually looking at the cast right now to see what his name is. Scott MacArthur. He plays Jimmy.
Yeah, he was Rex on Perfect Couples, another one-season gem of a sitcom.
So Scott MacArthur, it turns out, was a writer on the show, and they had cast somebody else as Jimmy, and then he had to go do another show. He, like, got picked up, and so they had to recast. And Scott MacArthur, his recollection, he was like, yeah, I guess he was like, you know, maybe can you come do this? And the brothers were like, as we recall, it was, no, you're doing this. Like you were going to be the guy. You may not have known. Oh, they made him audition and all this stuff. They took him out. This is a great story they told. They're like, they said, you know, we said, okay, look, yeah, can we take you to lunch? We want to talk to you about something. And he's like, oh, you know, great. They're gonna give me that, you know, they give me the gentle push, brush off, that kind of thing. And they played like he had not gotten, like he had really screwed up the audition and just made him miserable. And then they told him that he got the job. And it sounds like the whole energy of this was that's what they do. They screw with each other. Like Caitlin Olson and Scott were just kind of messing around the whole time. It was really funny. They talked about the youngest kid and sort of how they got this really cute kid. Like, they were trying to find someone sort of weird looking.
Yeah.
And I don't remember if it was Caitlin or somebody else, but they said, look, Caitlin is an executive producer on this as well. And I think she said, no, he's so cute that we'll be able to get away with so much stuff he does. And they do. I mean, you compare it less to Dewey.
This kid feels like It's Always Sunny to Seinfeld, like this kid to Dewey.
And they talked about casting Sophia Black, who was the teenager, and how Caitlin was reading with every single one of them, and they brought in these teenagers, and all of them were doing this sort of bitchy teen act. Mm-hmm. And Caitlin was like, yeah, I don't want to be in the room for that for more than 5 seconds. And so they finally needed Sophia to come in and be someone who's willing to sort of stand up to her. And I think it was during one of the casting sessions, she said something like, well, do you want to try it like this? And she's like, no, I'm not going to do that. And she's like, okay, good. Yeah, we got someone who's going to push back on me. And that they wrote the other child role. They wrote it for him after seeing him in Wet Hot American Summer.
I remember it was Peter Pan in the
Wet Hot American Summer. That was what it was. The two brothers were like, okay, I've got the kid for this. And one of them was like, you know that Peter Pan Geico ad? And he's like, no, I got the kid. You know that Wet Hot American Summer? And it was the same kid.
That's the same kid, yeah.
So
he's perfect for it.
Yeah, it was a really good panel. They had a lot of fun. They clearly loved the show. And I've become a devotee. I definitely loved it.
Yeah.
That's one of my favorite just standard sitcoms that's going right now.
All right, well, let's take a quick break because I want to come back and talk about a lot of these panels that went a lot more in depth of things. So there was a couple of TV shows that did dedicated panels, and we, Randy and I, got to check out the Alias panel.
Yeah, Alias Writers Panels.
Alias and, Writers Panel.
That one, I really have a fondness for Alias, but like so many others, I sort of had in my head that Alias had like two good seasons and then sort of went off the rails. And I had the same reaction. We'll talk about this when we get to Galactica. This made me want to go back and rewatch the Alias with sort of fresh eyes, knowing a little more about how TV works and sort of watch them working the problem, which is kind of what the last few seasons were.
Getting to like listen to the people behind the scenes, mm-hmm. I think softens the critical edge yeah. for me.
Yeah.
Like realizing, you know, these problems that we can just be so flippant about, oh, why'd you do this or that? There's oftentimes a really good reason why they had to do that or this. And it's not something that you can just easily dismiss. You can talk about like why there's weaknesses and flaws to that. But I think, yeah, it was just kind of a good learning experience to me.
The interesting thing to me about the panel, they had Ken Olin, who was an executive producer and director through the whole show. Sarah Kaplan, who was the producer, the only one there who had been there for the whole series. Mm. And she was a producer, an older British lady who I fell immediately in love with.
She's
and
fantastic.
She has a great story I want to mention. Andre Nemec and Josh Applebaum, two of the big writers starting on season 3. And Monica Wusu-Breen, who was on season 3 and then beyond, I believe.
Yeah, she also did Fringe and Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
She was somewhat quiet as far as contributing, but she threw in every now and then. I think the most interesting thing for me was there's a point at which the whole panel kind of turned to me into Sarah Kaplan explaining how the hell they got this done, because J.J. Abrams was coming from the notion of like, we can do anything. And
he was coming from Felicity with her. I think this is like some little like new spinoff project, and it's much more in the now realm of what we think of J.J. Abrams.
Yeah. Well, I think that's the thing. I think he was going to movies, and I think in his head he was already building these things. And they talked about how nobody could say no to J.J. Ken Olin had this story about how one of the executives at the studio was like, "Don't ever put me in a room with J.J. because I can't say no to him.
He's the cute kid from the Mick.
If he asks for more, if he asks for more money, we're going to give him more money, and I can't give him more money. Please don't put him in the room with me." But so they would have these crazy like action sequences and all this stuff. And that time, Jennifer Garner was like not only game for everything, but really wanted to do all the stunts. And they gave a lot of credit.
They all just are in awe of her. Yeah.
And so they told this story about the red hair wig in episode 1.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Which was great. Sarah Kaplan was doing, so this is kind of the problem solving they talked about. They were looking, they had all these wigs, they could not find the right red. And finally, they were walking around this campus. And Sarah Kaplan, one of her assistants nudged her and was like, "Look over there." And there's this sort of hippie girl with like, you know, this
rainbow
long,
color hair.
Long rainbow color hair. And at the very end, there's this red, and it's perfect. So she goes over to her and asks her if she can have a bit of her hair. Just a little bit for color matching for Alias. And the girl says no. And she was like, she's like, "This hair's been with me for 14 years. I'm not giving up even." And she's like, "Well, just a little bit." Sarah Kaplan was just boggled that this woman would not give up a little bit of her hair. And she's like, "I'll pay you for your hair." And she finally negotiates, you know, we can pay her a little bit for a few snippings. And she's like, "I don't have any money. I don't have any cash on me." Ken Olin didn't have any cash on him. So she gathered up a collection from the crew and paid $39 for just enough hair to make that wig.
That's insane.
Yeah, and that's the kind of thing they were doing, like, to make things happen. They talked about how the Super Bowl episode that was not originally, that was like a big episode with all this action stuff, that was originally a different episode, and people were telling JJ it was too dark, including his wife, I think. And so they had to sort of, in like 10 days, create this crazy big action episode that turned everything on its head. And they had to put all that together so quickly. And just, it sounds like these guys were just running like crazy behind the scenes to get everything working. And You can see it in the end product. It looks like an action movie every week.
So what about the Americans panel?
So the Americans I really liked. I have not seen this much this season. I've seen just the first episode. Mm-hmm. And what they did was they showed the first like 10 minutes of season 1. So I'd already seen, or this season rather.
So what didn't spoil you?
Didn't
there.
Spoil me anything. And then they brought up the creators, Joe Weisfield and Joe Fields, or Joe Fields and Joel Weisfield, because I never remember which one's Joe and which one's Joel. And they talked with the moderator, who was desperately trying to get them to spill things on season 6, and they kept stymieing her with like, "Yeah, well, who knows what's going to happen with that?" It was really good because they talked about sort of the psychology of it and the casting of the show, and sort of, this was almost the, I don't know that they'll be back next year because they don't tend to repeat shows at ATX. So this was kind of a overview panel for this show. And so they talked about all 5 seasons and the character arcs and discovering what the actors could do and that kind of thing without revealing anything about what was going in season 6 or really giving away much of 5. And I was very pleased with it. And it reminded me that I got to get back and watch the Americans.
You touched on this a little bit, but you also got to go to this creating casting panel, which sounds really interesting. I wish I would have been able to go.
I was fascinated by this panel. It's in collaboration with the Casting Society of America, which is like their guild, essentially. And
CSA is like one of the biggest ones.
They had Jennifer Houston and Liz Flahive, which are from GLOW.
Mm-hmm.
Tracy Lillenfield and Marta Kaufman from Grace and Frankie, Wendy O'Brien, Mike Royce, and Kurt Sutter from Sons of Anarchy and Enlisted. And actually, it wasn't Kurt Sutter. They had Paris Barkley still
Kurt Sutter. Out.
Yeah. And Paris Barkley was great, by the way. I'm glad they did it. But it was interesting because Jennifer Houston is someone who's very forceful. You saw her on Glow. She's a very forceful personality. Yeah. And she will talk about herself at the drop of a hat. Like, she will dominate a panel.
Yeah.
And she did talk a lot, and she had a lot of interesting things to say. But Marta Kaufman and Tracy Lillenfeld have known each other since their kids were in kindergarten and have finally gotten to work together on Grace and Frankie. Mm-hmm. And Marta Kaufman is like a, you know, take no shit, take no prisoners, longtime showrunner. And so those guys had so much to say and so much interesting insight into sort of the history of casting and how it all works. And so it was this mix of like the nuts and bolts of the technology of casting, how it used to be, you know, you'd come in to read and VHS, and now it's like much easier, and sort of griping about the technology and how it makes it easier, but they miss the intimacy of like having real auditions. They also talks about the, like, some of the inside baseball, where they talked about how some of the big agencies have agented their people out of jobs because they're like, no, you got to come and read for me. And the agent will be like, this guy's too big, he doesn't read. And they're like, okay, fine. And And so they talked about sort of like, they, Marta Kaufman talked about how she has a list, and if someone's with a couple certain agencies, like big agencies, that they will, she'll, you know, she'll still meet with them, obviously, but it's like a one strike against them immediately, because she said one of her philosophies was that life's too short. And so if an actor's going to be a problem, it's not going to fit with the cast, it's going to cause drama, it doesn't matter how good they are, there's somebody else who can fill the role. And it was interesting to hear them talk sort of openly about, you know, issues with agents and issues with actors and that kind of thing, and how much they love the actors and they want them to succeed and they want to be sort of partners in their career, the casting agents, and that a lot of actors don't get that. That the casting directors, like, bring them in over and over again because they're wanting to find the right role for them and that kind of thing. It was a fascinating look at a side of the industry I don't think we think about a lot, and I would love more of this kind of thing. I would love music supervisors and costume designers and all this kind of things, all of which has been done here at ATX Fest. Like, I love that we see different sides of the industry.
The best panel I got to attend was this Complex, Not Complicated, a look at a woman's character is what it's talking about. The panelists were Jennifer Robinson and Taylor Dearden from Sweet Vicious, and then we had Kira Sedgwick from The Closer, Liz Teigler from Casual, Mara Brock Akil from Being Mary Jane, and Mary McDonnell from Battlestar Galactica. And, you know, you have a couple writers, you have a showrunner, you have some actresses, and you also have some people that have been in the game for a long time. Mm-hmm. You have some young people and their perspective. And then you have ethnic differences, and all of them getting the chance to talk to each other about the issues of what they kind of face in the industry, about limited roles for women, and how they have to kind of push against that. It was brilliant hearing all their perspectives on this and the agreements they'd have, the bits of difference. There's this one particular question someone asked, and she was like, you know, I work in the industry on the back end, and me and some of my female friends, like, we were all talking about our bosses, and they were saying to me that they don't want to work with women bosses anymore because they feel like there's like a bit of nastiness, and it really hurt me. And, you know, I wanted to kind of hear your thoughts on that. And like, Kira Sedgwick was like, I am awesome all the time to my the people that work under me when I'm in a leadership role. But, like, you know, they were like, it's complex what's going on there. There's a lot of like cutthroat nature, like, once you kind of get up to that position, and you have to kind of like take that into account for the people there, and they also need to be responsible for like taking a step back and realizing that if they're not like supporting other women in this industry, that's how they made it there. And sometimes it's a little bit of like reflection, and you can't just cast aside someone either below you or above you because of how they are. And it's just really great to kind of hear all of that. It's not something like, you know, from my white dude perspective, get to hear as often. And yeah, it was a real privilege to get to attend that panel.
No, Grant, privilege is what you have.
True. This other one I attended was this TV theories panel.
I wanted to attend that. I've been interested to hear how that went.
I was excited for it. And, you know, the idea is, like, they wanted to discuss certain shows that you can kind of go into a deep dive. A problem that I have, well, I'll go into Reddit and I'll theorize about stuff. And, you know, how do writers kind of navigate that? The people that they had on this, Javier...
Griot Markswatch.
Griot Markswatch. Monica Owusa-Breen from Alias, okay. That we saw. Michael Rauch from Royal Pains. And Eric Goldman, the film critic from IGN, mm-hmm. were all there discussing this. And I feel like this had a lot more opportunity to have substance, but it felt a little bit more like either they don't engage. Like, Javier seemed to, like, read a lot of the theories, and mm-hmm. he was engaged more in that. But the other writers were like, yeah, I try to avoid that as best I can so I can keep insulated from it.
Yeah.
And that didn't allow a lot more of the conversation kind of flourish. If you're not engaged with the people that can be fanatics, right. or you're not aware of it, you don't concern yourself with it, then... I felt that stifled what could have been a little bit more interesting on the other side of that.
Yeah, I was really hoping that they would end up with panelists that were on shows where they have to engage with it and it's problematic, like
feeding into it.
Yeah, where it's difficult to keep your show going. I mean, there's shows that have to purposely punk their audience with misleading things. Guardians of the Galaxy 2, James Gunn made sure that a cast member was taken onto the Avengers set. So that they would get photographed by just random people going, hey, so-and-so's on set today. They must be in Infinity War.
It was
entirely to troll an audience or to try to keep a death hidden because our culture ruins upcoming stuff.
Right.
Yeah. And they would talk a bunch about like Westworld and Lost. And I was like, I wish like some of those people were on this panel as well to kind of like offer like that insight. It was interesting to hear Monica from Alias talk about that because that was a show that was going on before, you know, the internet really mm-hmm. like had these chat threads.
Right. Before full on Reddit.
Yeah, there wasn't a two screen watch for Alias.
Yeah, yeah. And like Twitter and like people could just like ruin things or like before they come out and like everyone kind of like gets spoiled on this. Hearing her perspective both from there and then like moving on to shows like Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. and working on that, I was also kind of surprised that, like that was one of the few times where a panel wasn't like heavily attended. And that was the problem of like a bunch of great panels were all scheduled at the exact same time.
Yeah.
And we were all debating, like having difficulty, like which one do we want to go see?
Yeah. But, well, that's a part of any kind of convention. There's only so many people can fit in a room. And so you've got to sort of strategically go like, you're not going to see everything you want to see because we can't let everyone see everything they want to see, or we can't let everybody in the room.
Yeah.
So you've got to force those Sophie's choices.
Yeah.
It was like, I mean, there's still a good amount of people. There's like 30 or 40 people.
Yeah.
But I feel like when there's less people all of a sudden in a TV theories one, it's like, yep, I'm one of the weirdos.
Sorry,
it's true.
Sorry, Grant.
I am one of the weirdos that like obsess too much about probably not the particularly like necessary thing on shows.
When you were in the room and there were too many people, were you like, this means something?
I have a theory here, guys. Les, you attended a bunch of panels.
Yeah, I went to a bunch of panels, and I'll admit, I let out a squee a couple of times when I realized that the thing in the other Alamo screen or the thing that other line is for. Is the super popular one.
Yeah.
There were a couple times where I was in the weirdo panel and I realized like, hey, what are those 400 people there for? Not this. Sweet.
Yeah.
and I'll admit like this morning I went to Paul Scheer's Indie Pilot Showcase, which mm-hmm. I'm so thrilled I went to. It conflicted with Glow. And so I had to kind of make a Sophie's choice there.
But you're going to see Glow.
What I knew I'd watch Glow when it came out on Netflix. I knew that the things he showed, one of them, there's no way he had legal clearance to show. I knew I'd never see him again. But also, I really wanted to go see the Suits script read this morning. I had tried to set up an interview that fizzled. Just a bunch of stuff didn't work out. I didn't get a fast pass to it. It got really full, and I wasn't able to parlay any way into it. And I thought, you know, if I go down there, maybe I can probably get in. But there's an off chance that I still won't. And by trying, I will miss any other thing I'd go to.
Right.
So I just kind of had to make a choice of like, you know what, we're not going to try to fight into Suits. I'm just going to make sure I can go to another thing. And so I kind of made choices like that all weekend. But I saw a ton of panels.
What was your favorite? Was it the Paul Scheer thing?
I saw a couple of deep dive panels on shows that I love that were kind of my terriers moments from last year for Randy. Middleman panel this year, I somehow managed to see that show when it aired 10 years ago on ABC Family, when it was ABC Family was so new that they still had a deal where a portion of their hours per day had to be religious programming. So Middleman ran next to 700 Club, which still had to be rerun. So, I mean, just weirdly, I've loved that show forever. It's not streaming anywhere. I came away from this weekend between that and Black Donnelly's, which is the other panel that I desperately wanted to see. It's a show, it was a one season wonder that I'm obsessed with. And both of those are shows that I would consider doing a deep dive Beach Cop style thing on. I came away from the weekend with kind of two competing, like, oh God, what do I want to drag people through? Because they're both such great shows. I loved both those panels. They had great anecdotes. I'm going to write up blog posts on both of them that were just wonderful to hear. Of the industry panels, I feel like Network Identity ended up being more interesting than I'd expected. It wasn't quite the panel I wanted it to be. I really wanted all the networks to discuss a little bit more
how they define themselves versus each other?
Yes, which they were a little unwilling to do next to each other on stage.
Right. I can understand the weirdness of it.
Exactly. You had a rep from Marvel, so he was purely a seller, and his answers were different than everyone else's. I mean, he has a deal with Freeform, who had a rep there. He has a deal with Netflix, who they all hate. he has a deal. I mean, so his answers were different. But the whole panel was good. It got a lot more candid about what makes good shows go there. I wish they had spoken to something like USA taking Mr. Robot, which so utterly breaks their brand to
right.
me. But in general, they spoke about Freeform lost 13 Reasons Why to Netflix.
And
they brought it up, and they expressly said that. They were like, we'd have made a fine show. We would not have made that show.
Yeah.
And it probably wouldn't have been as impactful. They spoke to the Marvel guy about, you know, why is Cloak and Dagger and New Warriors going to be on Freeform mm-hmm. when you have a deal with ABC, and then why do these other things go to Netflix? And he said, Tone, he said, you know, we have 10,000 IP properties just sitting, you know, 10,000 pieces of IP just sitting there to pick from. If we want to do a different Tone thing with Marvel, we just dig through until we find someone that fits it, and then we look into the landscape of distro channels and pick the one that fits it and try to make the deal. It ended up being a lot more interesting panel than I expected, though.
Yeah. So what about this, the digital lament?
That was interesting. The person from HBO there raised her hand as a cord cutter. And the entire panel team turned to her and went, what? Which was great. Mostly that ended up being kind of people talking in groups about their streaming shows or about their different shows. So these were folks that had shows on CISO, folks that had shows on Go90, folks that had Rooster Teeth that had shows on YouTube Red, like Red versus Blue and such. And so it was kind of neat talking about, particularly at the Rooster Teeth guys, they've had opportunities to take Red versus Blue to television, and then they refused every time because that show should not be on a normal tele. It shouldn't be on a real TV. That show's made to be seen on a computer. It is machinima. It is made to be seen in a more digital format, and they felt like they would disrupt their audience or run counter to the show's tone.
It's like a step backwards in a way.
Yeah, and they said getting to people to understand that when they refused was really difficult.
I mean, it's a pretty great stance. I really applaud them.
I did too. They spoke about Day 5, their next show coming out, and budget concerns, differences in freedom of notes on streaming versus budget, you know, what you can get away with. It was a very interesting panel. I wish it had been a little more abstract about cord cutting, and instead it ended up being kind of particular to the kind of three sets of people that had shows on three different streaming channels.
Yeah.
And they kind of spoke to their specific experience. It still ended up being a great panel.
And the showrunner defined?
That was exceptional. That was a series of showrunners. Greg Garcia, Javier Griot, Mark's Watch.
You got much better at pronouncing his name.
I am. I've been hearing him say it all weekend phonetically. It's been great. The showrunner that is currently doing Great News, who came off of 30 Rock, they all spoke really well about coming up in mentorship and what it meant to go from a mid-level writer's room to the showrunner and how does showrunning work. Like Greg Garcia spoke quite a bit about like improv and whether you allow improv on set and that really the showrunner's job is to kind of set these boundaries and then stick with them. And they all laughed about things like the wig. Alias story made me think of it. About, you know, your job is to, when people come up to you with five hats, and you don't give a fuck. But you cannot say that. Because that person spent all day today and yesterday picking out hats and printing out pictures and putting them in a binder and bringing you pictures of hats because that's their job.
Yeah.
And the hat to them is important. That the showrunner's job is kind of to pass on this confidence of making dumb decisions with utter
authority. Yeah.
So that you walk up and go, that hat, that is the hat. That's the hat that's got to be in this show. And if you're wrong, you go back later quietly and go, hey, I fucked up on that hat, man. We got to change that hat. I said, but that your job is to just make a million dumb decisions while keeping in mind your real job, which is to move the writer's room forward.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And they asked them all, you know, would you want more money on a show? Would you want more? It's like, well, you could always use more money on a show, but I've never done a show where I've gone, shit, we can't make this show because I need 10 grand more. Like, you figure it out. He said, at the end of every day, I want 4 more hours. Mm-hmm. He said, and if I could ask for anything tangible, every one of them said, I just need more writer ideas, more story ideas. I said, that's always the pinch. You can't pay for it.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, you just need more ideas.
So, Trumped Up TV, we kind of touched on this idea that one of the running themes was how this election cycle had ramifications on how people feel about writing. And this seemed like the panel that really defined that.
This kind of came down a little differently than I expected. The panel was specifically about whether or not, if you have a socially conscious show, it's pretty easy to see that obviously you need to tackle a lot of these things. But if your show is not overtly socially conscious, to what degree do you try to reflect these kinds of things, especially when the shift was this huge?
Yeah.
And some of them talked about having to write out a few jokes about Hillary or making sure that you have the right president in the frame photo on the wall when you walk through someone's office in a show, because you're shooting so far in advance on some of these things that you can't be topical. One person said specifically, you know, I don't want to do Trump jokes. You can go a million other places for right now, up to the minute, topical Trump jokes. My show shoots 2 months in advance. I can't beat that.
Yeah.
And there's no reason to try. Bo Williman, who writes House of Cards, or created House of Cards, the U.S. version. And they asked him specifically, did it change how you write politics? And he said, no, that as special as we would love to think this particular 5 minutes of human history is, other countries have already done all this before, and politics is always the same human motivations of greed and betrayal and ego that it always is, and that this may change the trappings of who your villains are. Like, Russians may matter again now, or ISIL may matter, or, you know, versus whoever would have been the villain in the 90s. Like, didn't Bond fight a tech mogul?
He did. He did.
So that, you know, it changes that, but that people are people, and conflict is conflict, and the same things that drive the people doing greedy stuff now is the same thing that drove greed in the 70s.
See, that's fascinating, because that's one of those things that, from our perspective, we've discussed. It's like, how crazy this election is that must have ramifications on shows like House of Cards and Veep.
Now,
like, how do you replicate that?
Of all the shows to have a ramification, Vampire Diaries. Julie Plec discussed having a writer bring back, it was going to be a flashback in an existing ship on that show. I don't follow Vampire Diaries enough to know what relationship.
Yeah.
But it was an existing, longstanding relationship. They were going to do a flashback scene that was going to be an abusive fight. Like, the male part of the relationship was do something horribly violent, but it was in the past. They were going to do it in a flashback, and then they were going to come back to the present and have them work through it, and that relationship continue forward. And after the election cycle, when they met back again afterwards and they talked in the writer's room, the writer of the episode brought it up, and she and Plec read it again and went, that relationship's over.
Yeah.
That relationship does not survive that act. I'm not writing the episodes that get her okay with that, and that they were done with it. And then a few episodes later, after some pushback, the writer came back to Plec and said, I've ruined the show. And she said, no, we made the right call. It was of all the shows to have a moment in the room of looking around and going, we write something with a serious rape through line. Vampires, by definition, have a little bit of a rape culture to their romance that has to be dealt with somewhat.
Yeah. Right.
And that of all, Plec was like, you know, years and years of doing this stuff. She said it was a little further awakening of like, got to treat this a bit differently.
Interesting. I forgot that they mentioned that a lot in The Americans, of course, the Russians and being more prominent and that kind of thing. And someone asked a very interesting question about, you know, you started this out and it was sort of a period piece, and the Russian, you know, how this all worked out is history. And now we're seeing it play out again. And it sort of changed the energy a little bit. And they talked about, someone asked the question of, could you do a show about sort of modern day threats? Like, could you do a show that was sympathetic to ISIS?
Oh, yeah.
And they talked about it. And he was like, yeah, you know, the problem is like Russians and Americans, they're different cultures, but there's still a sort of a certain similarity. ISIS is a very different culture. It's like, you know, he's like, and he talked about, he mentioned a, I believe an Israeli show that sort of does that, that did it very well. And he basically said, it was like, it's like, yeah, it'd be really complicated and really difficult, and let's do it.
Speaking of Bo Willimon, the other one that you got to check out was this unexpected and unlisted sort of panel.
So after seeing him on the Trumped Up TV panel and then seeing him just kind of around the, again, this fest is amazing, seeing him and Javier and such just around the hotel, listening to Javier talk about growing up in Puerto Rico and how what's happening to us now is really not that friggin' weird.
Yeah.
If you just want to read a little bit of history, was terrifying. Absolutely terrifying. But he and Willimon, after seeing them on panels and seeing Bo Willimon on panels, I knew I wanted to go see him speak again. And I ended up caught short with some time to kill and looked at my schedule. And the entire description for this, he's the moderator. He's the only panelist. And the description says, description to be written after event or following event.
That's perfect.
And I won't go into the crazy long anecdote that the man told, but he spoke extemporaneously for an hour. And if you ever have a moment to listen to Bo Willimon ramble for an hour, I don't know how in the hell that man survived his 20s, but it's amazing. Amazing. That's the craziest New York story I've ever heard anyone survive. And just impressive. And there was a theme to the whole thing. I mean, it wasn't just an anecdote. He used the anecdote to illustrate a much larger point about Chekhov's gun and writing and assigned meaningness when you're choosing what plot points to show in a story. It ended up being a great talk, but absolutely no plan for it. Had no idea what we were walking into. Sat down and just got a really cool hour out of the guy that created House of Cards. Nowhere else but this festival can I imagine sitting in a really small room and having that intimate of a weirdly personal conversation with that guy.
So not only are there fantastic panels during this fest, not only are there really cool screenings of ongoing shows, but then there are these feature events. I gotta say, the thing I was most excited to see was the Leftovers panel, which was like the second or third thing that happened on the very first day, on Thursday.
That was like you going to church.
Are you into that show?
It was. Well, the finale happened 4 days previous to this, and I'd read so many interviews that like Lindelof and Mimi Letter, who was co-showrunner alongside him and Tom Parada, so those three were there, and Maureen Ryan from Variety was the moderator, and I just read some beautiful article that she had written about how the Leftovers resonated with her and her emotional journey and some personal stuff that were so effective to her, and that like the Leftovers was a conduit. So all four of them being up there for this panel, it was such an exciting experience. They delved into like all these different aspects without going into, I don't want to say spoilers either, but they weren't like trying to like blatantly dwell too much on like lingering questions of like, well, when this happened, what did that mean? But right, like talking about the experience of it all and how like all of that, like for Lindelof in particular, he had a little bit of a rough go of it after Lost and kind of the fallout from a lot of vocal and shitty fans who decided that not only were they entitled to an ending that they had, like, in their mind, like, that was what they had to have, but since they didn't get that, they now get to harass him anytime he posts anything or engages with people online.
Any show he starts is just going to end badly. They just assume, and
It's just, it's the absolute worst of of fandom is evidence in how people treated Damon Lindelof. And, and you know, he's rightfully skittish about a lot of that and how a show ends, because, you know, he's on top of the world with how Lost was being received. And I thought rightfully so, like a lot of people loved it. And then when it ended and everyone kind of tore into him for how they wanted it to end, He was scared. And so, like, to kind of see him get a bit of redemption from this show, to see, you know, all the love and support from the audience and from Maureen Ryan, and kind of get to unpack what he was going for here. I was really excited to get to attend this. You saw it with me, Randy.
He looked about 50 pounds lighter spiritually. I mean, it's like he was having a good time. He was joking around. And I think having this finale land the way it did just really helped him deal with what is the trauma of the Lost reaction.
And come here to ATX Festival, to places, which is such a love fest in a way for, like, all these shows. No one's coming here to get shit on, because, like, it's like that Simpsons thing where Lisa Simpson's in, like, the second best band in the world, and all the audience goes to boo. Like, why would they come to my show just to boo me? Yeah. Like, no one does that. This is all, like, you go because you're excited to see these people. And
it was a great panel, and they really talked a lot. It felt like being in a podcast with Grant.
Yeah. Anyway, I was head over heels about that.
It was a great panel.
Everything else after that was just downhill.
Yeah, you started with that and then getting a picture with Lindelof, and I'm like, oh, Grant's done.
He's finished. Also got a picture with him. I was like, I'm going to be that bold.
And he was wearing a what's the lion's name? Frasier the Central Lion shirt, which I want one of those.
So good. Now, Les, you were super excited about the Black Donnellys. Like, what is it about that show that you love?
I always have a soft spot for kind of one season wonder shows where whether Black Donnellys would have become some amazing Sopranos type thing or whether it would have had an awful season two and season three or gone whatever, it never got a chance to. It's perfect in my mind. That thing just kind of rides off into the sunset in this just amazing one season 13 episode story about these Irish brothers inadvertently and kind of accidentally taking over the Irish mob in their corner. Of Chicago, I believe. That's where they are. No, the New York. Jonathan Tucker's from Boston. That's what it is. So they told Bobby Maresco, who was the creator of the show, it is literally written off him and his brothers. They have a sister they wrote off the show. She was furious. They wrote her out of the first script because he legit has a sister. And this really is just their childhood, kind of.
Oh, wow.
To a degree, I mean, slightly fictionalized. The show uses an unreliable narrator, which I have a soft spot for. So you get these constant retellings of, you have two cops interrogating a kid. You're going to tell us where the bodies are. And he's telling this, well, first I got to tell you about this. And, but the stories keep telling, like, you know, 2001, I just gotten away from this woman who, you know, and they're like, hey, you were in juvie in 2001. And it cuts back. 2003, I was a kid, try again. 2005. And, you know, the clothes just keep changing and the story keeps changing and you have no idea. It's like watching a crime story about Eli Cash telling you about the tenant bombs. This kid worships them, and you have no idea how much of this is true, but your storyteller clearly worships the subject. They had a couple of the actors there, and they got to tell a lot of fun anecdotes and weird origin stories of how that show got made. It's a show that I loved. It just clicked with me. It has a great pilot. It's on Netflix entirely if you can ever get a chance to watch it.
I mean, I never caught the show, but I heard such great things about
it. And it was a lot of first roles. It was first roles for a lot of these people or second or third role, you know, early on in their career. Olivia Wilde's in it, and so they all got to have jokes who all had a crush on Olivia Wilde.
Everyone in the world.
Billy Lush, one of the actors that plays one of the other brothers, he was there, and it's this... This job was both his first acting job. It hired him away from flipping burgers. He met his wife on set. They're still married. He was wearing every bit of swag he still had from this. Hat, shirt, everything. If there were Black Donnelly underwear, that dude was wearing them. Just ended up being a great, great panel. You could feel the love coming off of this show and how much they all enjoyed making it and how special of a deal it was to them.
Yeah, we got to see the Battlestar Galactica, Randy and I, panel, and wow.
This was the closing night panel, and I loved Battlestar Galactica the first two seasons, and then I hated the ending so much. More than I hated the ending of any TV show, like, it ruined the show for me. Like, I never want to see it again.
Man.
And the more I've thought about it, and this was, I think, a reaction. Like I said, you don't think about what the creators were going through. the more I thought about it, I'm like, you know what? That's a reaction. It's still a really good show. I still like a lot of it. And then we went to this panel because I still have a lot of fondness for it 10 years on. And first of all, it was an amazing panel. But second of all, by the end of it, I was like, God damn it, now I want to rewatch the whole show. And it's all on Hulu now, so I'm probably gonna.
I mean, I'm in a similar boat. I've watched the first two seasons three times, and I've never made it past that. Not because I don't think it's good. It's just like I always like stop right there for some reason, and then I kind of like forget, and I'm like, well, I might as well start at the beginning and just go again. I'm like, I get wrapped up in it, and then I just like don't go to three.
Same with me, Grant. That's a binge that just hardly ever finishes out. Battlestar fizzled for me, and I just that's why I didn't fight to go to that panel.
It's such an endeavor to take on.
What I'll say is the panel, first of all, the design of the panel.
They staged it beautifully.
Yeah, it was great.
Up in their game here.
Yeah, and then this was clearly a group of people that loved each other, loved this show, and really appreciated being brought out to talk about it. Because, I mean, not only is it a bunch of legendary actors and great up-and-comers, but, like, they all were funny and engaged, and it was like having a family reunion for them. And that energy came through into the audience, which was at the Paramounts was gigantic and packed.
And like, you know, all of the questions that like down the line, they're all telling such like really good anecdotes, like behind the scenes and
how they got hired.
And yeah, it was just like, it was so fun. Yeah. Like for me, like being sort of familiar with it, I was still like fully engaged in every single one of these people on this panel and excited to hear the answers that they'd tell and just seeing their reactions with each other. They all love each other. Well,
they're all hilarious. I mean, Edward James Olmos and Mary McDonnell are both commanding presences. There's like elder statesmen of TV. Mm-hmm. Ronald Moore at this point has done a lot of really good sci-fi. Battlestar Galactica to get the tops of them, but he was also Deep Space Nine. You know, he's a notable guy in the industry. And then you have like
Trisha Helfer.
James Callis was hilarious. And their stories of like being skeptical of sci-fi and then falling in love with this and demanding to do it. And Katie Sackhoff talking about how she was like in her 20s and this was one of her first big roles and how proud her dad was going to be that she got this role that was not like a typical guy. And the story she told about like she got the script, she was Starbuck and she called her dad. She's like, oh, he used to watch this. He's going to be so proud. And she said, I'm Starbuck. And he says, what? And just, yeah, Starbuck. He said, have you read the script yet? He said, no. He said, read it and give me a call back.
I know. Have you seen the show?
Have you seen the show?
Have you ever seen the original?
That's right. She and her friend. And
go watch the original.
They watched the original and they watched the scene and they're like, that's weird. They talked about Starbuck, but I never saw her. Where was she? and they're like, and their friend's like, Katie, rewind. We missed it. And they realized that it was Dirk Benedict and it was Starbuck. And she called her dad and he was like, yeah. And she said, she's like, I went to the, you know, the dial up message boards. She said, I went down to the internet cafe. They kept making fun of how 10 years was so different. I went to the internet cafe. I paid my $11.99 for an hour and I got on the message boards and I'm like, oh, you poor thing.
Oh, yeah. And even back then, people were shitty.
Yeah.
Always reliably shitty on message boards.
Yeah. But the stories about like,
they brought in Apollo and like on Skype.
On Skype in France, and he couldn't hear that well.
Skype's always just kind of going to be a bit of a clusterfuck.
But it was a hilarious disaster.
How all of them just kind of rally, and they're performers. And they just like took up the mantle of like performing and laughing about the situation. And like you said, Edward James Olmos was doing like tech support on Skype.
And James Callis and Trisha Helfer talking about their first sex scene and how they went down to the basement and practiced taking off this crazy latex get up
and making out
so they wouldn't be uncomfortable with one another. Like this was amazing behind the scenes stuff that made me want to watch the show again. And there were two notable things for me. One was, I have always held on to this. There's this, the crawl at the beginning of Battlestar Galactica says the Cylons, blah, blah, blah. You know, there are 12 colonies, Cylons attack, and they have a plan.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, you never told me what the fucking plan was. It pisses me off. Why is it in there? And Ronald D. Moore said, David Icke, one of the producers, said, yeah, put in, they have a plan. He's like, what? There is no plan. What are you talking about? He's like, no, it doesn't matter. It's just marketing. And he's like, I've been asked questions about this for the last 10 years. There was no fucking plan. All I ever wanted was for someone to say that.
And he said it.
And he said it. And I'm like, oh, thank God. You're as frustrated with it as I am. And that made me, that honestly made me forgive everything that made me mad about the show. I'm like, oh,
your debt is cleared.
You got screwed. David Icke, I have beef with now. But the other thing was, I was honestly going to get up and ask this question, and I'm glad I didn't because it would have undercut it. But I wanted to ask about the So Say We All, because we're in a big group of Battlestar Galactica fan. Edward James Olmos, Admiral Adama is on the stage.
What were you going to ask?
I was going to ask if he could lead us in a chorus of So Say We All.
We got that.
I was going to get up and say, I apologize for this, but when am I ever going to get the chance? And I'm glad I didn't do it because they closed out. The Entertainment Weekly editor who was running it was just as good. And he's like, he's really the only one we can add this panel.
Yeah.
And Edward James almost got us and led the whole chorus of So Say We All, just like the end of the first episode of the movie. And man, so good.
It was a perfect end cast.
That's great.
Yeah.
So, you know, running down, you know, the rest of the fest, we ran into a lot of cool people. Les, you have to tell the story.
I got recognized. Yes. Yes. No, I mean, I got coffee next to celebs and like, I'm not going to go talk to that person or anything, but I was sitting in a panel and the person next to me, we were just chatting about, they moved a lot of the name tags around and we were talking about whether they changed a panelist. And all of a sudden she goes, your voice sounds really familiar. And I literally said, it can't be this, but I do a podcast. And really, what podcast? The TV. My husband and I listen to that. And so I ended up meeting Lauren and Josh, who were super nice folks and really honest and held my stuff while I went to the bathroom.
That is amazing.
Yep, yeah. It's never happened to me. It's never in my life happened to me in any job, on anything, anywhere. So, yeah, we have fan. They are named Lauren and Josh. They are not related to us, and I don't know these people. but they were super nice.
Well, I think that's confirmation that we have at least two listeners to this podcast.
And I added a couple more. Christina, you're listening now. Claire, you better be listening because I got you into bajillion. So all weekend, everybody was so nice. All the conversations I had.
I need to get us new business cards to hand out.
Yeah. I got asked a couple
updated
times.
Ones.
Nothing against the other nerd conventions that I love going to. I love comics. I love sci-fi. But the fan conversations that I had here were a different tone. There wasn't an entitled... I deserve this ending to this thing, or like everything was just a fan. Like everybody just loved these properties and wanted to just talk about them and be near them and be near other people who were excited about them. I really haven't felt this about comics since I was little.
Yeah, I was when I was waiting in line for Glow, I was talking to a couple ladies and it was amazing because all you have to do is turn to the person next to you and say, so how's your fest going?
Yes.
And then immediately you're in a question of, oh, what's your favorite show? What's
Did
your
you
favorite
go to
thing?
Such and such?
What's your favorite thing you saw here?
What about this panel?
Yeah. And it is. They stepped up their brand this year. They called it TV Camp for Grownups. And that's what it is. It's like you're suddenly in amongst a group of like-minded people. And television is not a genre. Television is a medium. So it feels like we should be running into people who, like, we don't watch any of the same shows. But that never happens. I run into tons of people who don't watch the same shows as me, but there's always some kind of point where we can connect on some show or some panel. And yeah, it's a huge community builder. It's great.
It's so awesome. We also went to our annual, I guess now, podcasters that do TV podcast meetup.
Yeah.
And it seemed like double in size this year.
Yeah, we met some new people.
A bunch of new people. It was really cool.
Yeah, we met Derek from Geekdom Fancast.
Yeah, Geekdom Fancast. We met Tamar from the Shipping Room podcast.
Yeah, I talked to her a lot.
Yeah, which it's a really cool sounding podcast. But basically, what they do is they go and like break down the relationships in different TV shows and use that as kind of the springboard for talking about like larger themes in shows.
This was also the first ATX since we have had the Permanent Record Network.
Permanent Record.
And so I had a great time. Like I knew more people. Like I saw Key and Clyde from This Is Us and Pilot Watching numerous times.
We hung out with Melissa
from Televixen, who I absolutely adore. She's in Canada, so this is like the one time a year I see her, and that was a great time. And her husband Bill, and
it was wonderful to see them.
It was so good.
I love that I kept being able to turn around and see other folks from the Permanent Record Network or somebody else that we knew.
We were all over this fest.
I also want to say a special thanks to Kelly McCabe and Susie for buying me a beer on the very first day in the very first panel. y'all didn't have to do that.
Nice. And I wanted to thank our patrons because, you know, without you guys and your support over these past couple years of our podcast, we all got to attend because of you guys. We all got to, we were able to get new recorders so that we would be able to do a lot of these interviews that you're going to be hearing throughout the week. And, you know, really, guys, we can't thank you enough for this.
Yeah, you can probably hear in our voices how happy we are coming off a 4-day weekend where we did this, and that is all down to you guys helping us. So we really appreciate it.
This is the most little kid fun that I've had in my 30s easily. This is just a blast.
And thanks again, I don't know if they'd even hear this, but to Emily and Caitlin for organizing. Emily Gibson and Caitlin McFarland, the two people that created the ATX Television Festival here in Austin.
They are so awesome.
And we can't tell you listeners enough, please come down to this, because we have such a great time. It's such like a mecca for us.
It is our choice.
Yeah.
If you have the means, I highly recommend picking up a badge.
So what do you guys want for next year?
I don't know. I mean, we already had Terriers.
How is there not an anthology panel this year? How is there not a panel with Ryan Murphy talking about the fact that anthology shows did not exist 6 years ago?
That's got to happen.
And now they're everywhere.
Now they're friggin' everywhere. Feud, American Crime Story. I mean, granted, these are all the same person, but
Room 104
is now an anthology show. Yeah. You have Dimension 404. You have... That was the one missing theme piece of like what's happening in the television landscape that we aren't talking about. Where did anthology shows come from?
Next year, man. Next year.
You know what show we haven't seen yet?
What?
How do you not? Lost.
Lost.
When is Lost going to be?
Lost
that
reunion.
That would be a dream.
A Lost reunion?
I want a Lost reunion. I want to have some of the Marvel Netflix shows to kind of pop in.
You know what shows I also would like? News Radio.
Radio reunion would be awesome. Well, can't completely, but
can we cross our fingers and say Seinfeld?
Oh, that'd be amazing.
Yeah,
I just don't think that's happening.
I'd actually love The Critic, like the writers and John Lovitz. Like that'd be great too. There's so much they can still do.
Liquid Television panel.
Oh yeah,
but you know, as far as you know, we'll have to worry about our dreams because it's always exciting to just see what they come up with each year.
Whatever they put together is always great.
No, season 7 is going to kill it.
Yeah. Guys, well, let's wrap it up there. This has been an extra long special episode talking about ATX Television Fest 2017 Season 6. And yeah, that was awesome.
That was great. Yeah.
All right, until next time,
TV Dudes out.
The TV Dudes is an independently run podcast and a member of the Permanent Record Podcast Network. We are exclusively listener supported. If you'd like to help us out, please go to patreon.com/TV Dudes. You can like us on Facebook and Twitter at TV Dudes and help us out on iTunes by giving us a 5-star rating and writing a review. To find out more about us, go to thetvdudes.com and permanentrcrd.com. I'm Grant Davis. Thanks for listening.